This is the Limitless, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley at horticulture.com. This week I'm talking to Jonathan Pageau. This is the audio version of our conversation. The video version will also be available on YouTube. I'll link it in the show notes.
Oh, hello.
Hello. You seem like you're in a bunker of some kind.
Symbolically, but not literally. It's my attic.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Oh, there. I see the stairs down there. Okay.
Yeah. I built those stairs, actually. It's one of my proudest accomplishments. All right. Well, let's start. I have lots of things I want to talk about, of course, and no way of knowing if we'll get to how many of them we'll get to. So I thought that we would start, or that we could start, anyway, we'll see, with liminality. Mm-hmm. It being the theme title of my podcast, and I know that you've talked about it and looked into it a lot and referred to it. And Mike, in the days leading up to this conversation, I've been thinking about the relation between liminality and logos. And I don't have anything fully formulated, but that seems kind of the perfect place to start a conversation anyway, with half-formed thoughts and perspectives. And I'm not sure at what point I made the correlation anyway between liminality and the threshold of limen and the ratio of logos. But to me, I mean, one of the ways that I formulate or conceptualize or relate to the idea of logos is as a colon.
Sorry?
As a colon, as in okay. The grammatical
okay.
thing, yeah. As in you have a ratio 2:1, for example, right. That is written with the numbers and the colon in between the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, limen is the threshold, the space between.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the vesica piscis, or however you pronounce that, vesica piscis, the two intersecting circles, and then the fish-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Ellipsis, whatever the term is, where they intersect. So I've just been kind of running over that in my thoughts, like this notion of Christ the Logos as being, the Christian formula is as God and man in one.
Mm-hmm.
And the space between, or the ratio between the infinite, which is God, and the finite, which is man. And that logos, or that principle that rations the infinite into the finite, how does that correspond with the idea of liminality and the threshold?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, at least in my understanding, there's a difference between the place where two things meet, in the sense of let's say a sexual union, okay, and the difference between a place where two things meet in the sense of a buffer in between two things, and so the notion of liminality, or of the threshold, has more to do with a kind of separation which preserves order, in the sense that it preserves separation. It's a place of an indefinite space. So it's actually a place of chaos. Usually it's a place of monsters, and it's a place it's sacred to it in a sense, but it's sacred in the sense that it's undefinable, because it is in between two things, right? It's a mysterious thing, in the sense that that it's a non-place, right? It's kind of an in-between. Whereas there's also the notion of a union of two things in the sense of a sense of a sexual union, which will give then a synthesis, let's say, of two things. And so in the sense of Christ, there really is an insistence in the Church Fathers that Christ is not a mixture. It's really important, like that Christ is not a mixture of man and human, right? So he's not a monster. He's not like the Nephilim, let's say, in the Old Testament. He's not liminal in that sense. But he is fully man, fully God, fully joined at the same time. So it is obviously it's an impossible thing. I mean, it's not also meant to be possible in the normal sense, right? It's meant to stretch your capacity to envision something that is beyond our understanding. And so in that sense, the incarnation at first has more to do, I think, with this notion of a union of heaven and earth, let's say, in that sense. But then, at least in the Christian term, it's obvious that Christ then, the Logos moves out, right? Moves, let's say, from the center and fills up the entire world. Like you said, he's in a sense the ratio of everything. But in Christian terms, it's definitely shown that goes all the way into the limit, all the way into the marginal space. And so that's why Christ is always moving out. So he's the shepherd, but he moves out to the lost sheep, right? So he moves out to that lost thing, that thing that is no longer in the flock, that's no longer considered, that is liminal. He goes to the Samaritan. The Samaritan is a confused Israelite, right? In Israel, is in the Israelite's vision, he's the Samaritan is the one who has mixed the pure let's say the pure practice of the Israelites with the foreign gods. Okay, so the Samaritan is a liminal figure, and so you see Christ moving out constantly towards these liminal figures. He goes to the tax collector. A tax collector is an ambiguous character who's in a way a kind of traitor to his own people, as he's taking taxes from his own people to give to the foreign power, let's say. So every single character, if you look at almost every single character in the story of Christ, they are almost always liminal characters. So the adulterous woman, the fisherman, all these characters and so Christ, the image of Christ is that Christ is the fullness, let's say, but the fullness, that's the mystery of Christ, is that the mystery of Christ is that his fullness fills up the entire space all the way into death. And so all the way into the deep, where even in the liminal spaces of the world, he finds those divine sparks. So the idea of fishing, that's what fishing is, right? Fishing is this idea that there are these shiny living things in the chaos that you can pull out of the chaotic space on the border. And so I think that's why Christ also is crucified. That's why Christ also, is treated like a thief, like a common criminal, because he moves from the Holy of Holies, let's say, into liminality. Or you could also see that he moves from liminality all the way into the Holy of Holies and kind of joins all of that together. And that's why, I mean, that's also why the crazy image of as Christ dies on the cross, you know, the veil of the temple is ripped. And so it's like he moves through the entirety of the cosmic space. That's why it's really hard to talk about Christ, because if you focus on one aspect of him, you could say, that's why some people will say, oh, Christ is a revolutionary, because they'll see in his story certain aspects of him where he associates with the marginal. But then if you look at other texts, it describes Christ as a king, as a priest, as the judge. So he's the priest, the king, the judge, but he's also the criminal. He's also the one who in a way subverts some order. And so he has everything kind of jammed into his story, which makes Christ very difficult to fathom, and makes modern historians crazy, because they try to find tropes in the story of Christ, and they notice that the tropes go in every direction, because he's a carpenter, so he's a technical person, but he's also a priest, and he's also a rabbi, and he's also a healer, which are things that usually don't kind of fit together. And so all of that comes together. But I think in terms of liminality, in terms of the story of Christ, I think that's the way to see it, is to see Christ moving out from the highest place, let's say, and filling up the entirety of space, and going through going all the way into the not undefined of the liminal space, and kind of crossing through. But I would be careful to, honestly, I think I would be careful to want to associate Christ with liminality too much on his own, because that's what the Nephilim are. Like that's what the cherubim is. The cherub is a liminal creature. The Sphinx is a liminal creature. You have these creatures that guard the threshold, and those are associated with the liminal, because they are in between, and they're also a mixture of different identities, right? They themselves represent the not undefined space of the in between, let's say, of a liminal space. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Like Keck.
Yes, Keck is definitely a liminal figure.
And the generally tricksters are more associated with liminality.
Yeah.
Christ is definitely not a trickster. Doesn't seem to have the characteristics of a trickster. Although
there is one trickster aspect to Christ, and it's not in the gospel, but it's in the traditions of Christ, which is that when he reaches the edge, right, when he reaches the very bottom of death, there's this image in the gospel of Nicodemus, where Christ dies, and then you have the devil and Hades in hell, like celebrating, because they've won, right? They know we've gotten God, like we've killed God, we've won. And then here comes Christ down into hell, but it's the trick of saying, oh, we're taking the light and we're going to pull it into the darkness. We've won, but if you pull light into darkness,
everything's not darkness anymore.
Darkness is filled with light. So it's presented in the Gospel of Nicodemus as this final trick, where Christ, by dying, actually tricked death into resurrection. So that's the one trickster aspect of Christ, but it makes sense that it would happen right at the very edge in the liminal space, when he enters into that space where it's kind of like the final trick. You see that in the story of Saint Christopher too, where Saint Christopher is presented as a trickster the whole time during the story of Saint Christopher, where he tricks the Canaanite king into revealing to him, the devil. Then he goes to the devil and he tricks the devil into revealing to him Christ. And then he tries to find Christ, but he can't find him and he can't follow Christ. And then finally, it's Christ who tricks Saint Christopher into crossing the river. And so going across into baptism and basically resurrecting on the other side. And it's only when Christopher is on the other side, the monster is on the other side, that he kind of realized that in a way he's been tricked. He didn't know what he was doing when he was doing it. So that's actually the same structure as Christ going down into death. And then, because he goes down into the water in the same way that he goes down into death.
Well, I think my own experience anyway, there's two kinds of trick, and one is from trickiness, which is the deliberate intent to trick or deceive, and the other is just from an innocence. The innocence can actually end up tricking a kind of mindset that's cunning and calculating and actually can't predict the outcome. So that's more like what you're describing with Christ as the light that lets itself, because it surrenders to reality, it lets itself get pulled down into the darkness, not as a trick, but simply because that's its mission and its purpose and its relationship to reality is to surrender. And then the darkness experiences that as a trick. But actually,
yeah, they experience that as a trick. Yeah, I see what you mean. I think that makes sense to see it that way, in the sense that it's actually because they're so upside down that something as forthright as light, it almost appears as a trick to them, because they're upside down.
The thing that you zeroed on there about Christ moving towards the margins, and then the ultimate embodiment or expression of that is when he goes down into Hades after the crucifixion. Now, that to me is a non-Christian. I mean, I was raised an atheist, and now I'm definitely on this threshold where I'm neither Christian nor non-Christian. Maybe we can get to that or not. But anyway, the thing that always drew me to the Christ archetype or the Christ story was this element that he was drawn towards the margins, that it was this all-redeeming quality. And my path was, without going into that in too much depth, but was more of a sorcerer's path, and like I identified with darker archetypes. But insofar as I saw that Christ, by his very nature, had to incorporate all aspects of the human psyche and human experience, including, or in a sense, especially those that we perceive as irredeemable. Mm-hmm. But the nature of Christ is that he can redeem everything, or he does redeem everything by his nature. So then the mythological narrative of his descent into Hades after the between the crucifixion and the resurrection, that has always been very compelling to me, and it's not something that is talked about an awful lot. Like, there isn't anything in the Bible about that, for example.
No, it's not. It's there in the Bible, but it's there in a very imagistic way. And it's also there in the, in a culmination of Old Testament stories. So if you see that Christ dying and being resurrected as a replay, or let's say a, based on the prototype of Jonah going into the whale, or of the Israelites going through the Red Sea, the Israelites crossing the Jordan. There are all these images in the Old Testament of going down into chaos and then coming back in a kind of glorious way. And then Christ himself uses the image of Jonah to talk about his death and resurrection. And so it's through all those stories that it's there, but it's there more in the structure, let's say. And then later in Christian tradition, it came out in a more explicit manner. And I think also connecting it in a way with Greek myth to talk about the descent into Hades more in a manner which would resemble, something you would see in a Greek epic, like Odysseus or, Aeneas or something like that. The difference that happens that's really interesting in the story of Christ, which shows all kind of what Christ is that in the descent into Hades that you find in Greek myth and in Roman myth, it is always is either going in for one person and then bringing them out, or going in and coming out, just kind of by yourself. But then in the story of Christ, we really have this idea that as he comes out of Hades, he mm-hmm. empties Hades. Mm-hmm. Right. It's a very mysterious thing, because you have to think non-temporarily outside of time to understand what that means. But we really have this notion. We say it at Easter in the Orthodox Church. We say Hades is empty. The tombs are empty. There is no one in Hades anymore. He, mm-hmm. as he came out of Hades, he brought all of us with him. Mm-hmm. So Christ is, I always say that Christ is a culmination, not only of the Old Testament, but of a lot of Greek, and other pagan myths. He's actually a culmination of all these stories brought together into one person. That's one aspect where you see that, where it's like, yeah, he went into Hades and came out, like Orpheus did, but he brought everybody back with him, So it's like this glorious surprise, let's say.
Yes, right. So, and that was where I was initially going with that, was that it seems as though that was one of the primary purposes or functions, is probably not the right way to talk about it, but inseparable from the crucifixion resurrection process was this journey that redeemed humanity and in a very symbolic, possibly even literal fashion, went into the darkest, deepest place in existence, hell, the shadow of the psyche, and brought forth by the trajectory of the journey. Like, you wouldn't have to see that Christ went there to rescue, but simply the fact that he went there and then returned, and in the process drew all these
everybody with him.
Everybody with him. But the other thing that's occurring to me now, which I haven't thought about in ages, and you can tell me if there's a source for this in scripture or not, was this idea that when Christ came forth from Hades, not only did he bring the damned souls behind him, but he drove the demons in front of him.
What do you mean by in front of him?
Well, as I say, this is not something I thought about for ages, and so now I'm not sure where I got it from, but somewhere or another, I came across the notion that, relating to the end times and the apocalypse was this notion that Christ's journey to hell was like a great clearing out, if you will, of all of the, you know, the residual demonic elements of the human soul, and that this was symbolically represented by Christ actually driving the demons out of hell, and hence there'd be a period at the end times when the earth was flooded with these demonic entities.
No. Yeah, I've never heard that described that way. And one of the complicated things as well is that it's not like they're not completely related, at least conceptually, but let's say in terms of theology, in terms of the Bible, there is a difference between hell in the sense of Hades and Gehenna, like the fire, let's say the cosmic fire, or the fire at the end of times. Those two things aren't actually the same in terms of the story, let's say the big story. And so the idea of going into death and bringing everything out of death is not totally the same as this notion at the end of times of the purging fire, let's say. Those aren't the same. The idea of the purging fire is, at least in some Orthodox circles, not in all Orthodox circles, but there is a strain in Orthodox thought which talks about the notion that the fire at the end of times, or that the purging fire, is actually the presence of God, that it's actually the result of God, of theosis of the entire cosmos, of all of the cosmos participating or being completely made transparent to God. And that kind of transparency to God, it's as if in a way our mortal bodies, you know, like our manifest existence in terms of body and existence, it's almost as if in a way it separates us maybe from God in a way, but in a way it also protects us from God, mm-hmm. in the sense that because we have our passions and we have our idiosyncrasies, you know, it actually stops us from burning up. Because, and so the notion is that in let's say the fully revealed everything, that all those passions, all those things that we haven't settled, that are still kind of in us, are going to manifest themselves as this burning fire, right? It's as if I always kind of use the image of saying that if I do something horribly wrong, let's say to you, or I do something really resentful towards you, and then you turn around and you come to me with the most open love, like complete forgiveness, like no hypocrisy at all, complete forgiveness and absolute open love towards me as I do this horrible thing to you, then for me, I have a choice. Either I can accept that and fall to my knees in forgiveness towards you and ask you forgiveness for what I've done, or what your love towards me is going to burn the hell out of me. It's going to be like St. Paul talks about embers on my head, right? And so that's kind of the image of Gehenna at the end of times, is this notion of God filling up the cosmos, and whatever pride, whatever ego we hold on to is going to burn, because we'll be faced with this pure, you know, fullness of divine love, and if we don't want to submit to it, then we're going to be in hell in terms of fire. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like, and so Hades is different. Hades is really, really more this notion of the dark, like the dark deepness, right? Of this, of the deep and the chaos and all that. So it's different from the fire, let's say, the burning fire.
So it's the difference between like a purging and an annihilation. I mean, that's the best way I can understand this distinction in terms of, well, let's bring it back to the finite and the infinite, that we as mortal, finite human beings, I mean, however you look at it, there's no way of avoiding the reality of the infinite, of the eternal, just as abstracts, mm-hmm. because time and space are nested in something that is greater. Like they are basically, we can only conceive of them as infinite, and yet we can't conceive of the infinite or of the eternal. And so it's like we're in this double bind where we can't relate to a reality that we can't escape from. And this can be signified by God. I'd say it even has to be signified by God. Like, we have to humble ourselves before something that is so incomprehensibly overwhelming. And that what a big aspect of that is that it's inherently terrifying. It's inherently threatening the infinite. There's no way that it can't be. Because we can't.
That's something that everybody's lost today. It's like we're people are so allergic to speaking of God as the this kind of overwhelming fire, you know, this overwhelming thing that you in a way should be, like you said, that there is, it does make you tremble because it is so beyond everything. And so it's funny that you still today people get annoyed when you talk about God in those terms, because they, you know, I mean, also it's always because they want to bring God down into the level of, you know, our daily interactions, where they don't like the idea of someone who's very powerful. But reality comes at you, you know, like the meme says, you know, reality comes at you. There's nothing you can do. You have to kind of be willing to understand how big it is, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's a leap of faith in itself. And, cause I've observed this in my own psyche recently, as I've been moving more towards the possibility of an orthodox faith, let's say, at least considering it, that what you've just said, that whenever I would think of God in terms of something outside of me that I needed to submit to, I would immediately project onto that through my own psychological patterns and my own associations. It's like in Fight Club, he said, if our fathers are our models for God, what does that tell us about God? Consider the possibility that God hates us. Well, we can't get, you know, past
that. It's hard to break that, yeah.
Yeah, until we get past it, of course. But what I realized while I was wrestling with that was that it was inherently contradictory, because I was resenting the idea of an all-powerful, all-good, infinite, you know, absolute deity, because I felt that somehow it was unworthy, that I would be surrendering to something that would abuse me, basically, which is inherently contradictory. Because if I'm accepting the premise that God represents the inevitability, let's say, I don't want to even say concept, of an absolute supreme good principle, then why on earth wouldn't I want to surrender to that?
Yeah. Right?
That actually exposes, you know, the mechanism, the defense mechanism in me. It was very hard for me to actually get through that. Yeah.
I can imagine. Especially if we've had difficult relationships with authority in the past, it's hard to break those patterns of psyche, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like you can't imagine the infinite. Well, that is I mean, there's no way around that. Like, we can't ever imagine the infinite. But if you bring it down to a more human level, we can't imagine what we haven't experienced. So if I've never experienced a benign authority figure, a benign paternal figure, a benign power, then how do I imagine it? And going to religion has not been effective for me, not just because of my social conditioning, which was to be an atheist, if anything, that actually kind of cleared the slate for me, but because of just the many abuses. Like, one can't separate the power abuses from religion, far from it. They're so inextricably bound up.
And you'll still face it, like, no matter where you go. I mean, in the Orthodox Church or in the Catholic Church or in the Protestant, all churches have people in them who are horrible people and who all those churches have authority figures in them that are horrible. But I mean, there's both. I mean, it's just like any human organization. You sometimes have the chance to meet. I mean, I've had the chance. I never felt like I've been around horrible authority figures that were that bad. I've had the chance to have pretty good people around, priests and everything, people with good intentions. So but I know, I hear stories. You hear horrible stories of that. So it's not like you're not at the risk to do that. Luckily, you know, most of the time, I always tell people, like, most of the time when hell, like the end of time, like the last judgment was represented, you know, in frescoes or in paintings, if you look at who's in hell, it's always kings, bishops, and priests. You know, right. there's never common people in hell. So people have always known that you know, power corrupts, you know, and it attracts sometimes bad people. But at the same time, without it, we have no cohesion, you know. So that's the kind of the catch-22 of that situation.
It's a double bind, yeah. As well, I mean, something that I've been writing about for some years now, which is close to what you just said about power corrupts, that the possibility, I would say inevitability, that knowledge also can corrupt. And there's the correlation, think Castaneda, but it's certainly not restricted to that knowledge is power. I mean, I'd say that's pretty consistent through our culture, that knowledge has in some sense been the ultimate currency and commodity, hence there's been the secrecy and elitist, you know, kind of treatment of knowledge. And in some ways you could say that's changed with internet and blah, 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 but in other ways it hasn't changed at all. So one of the things that I would say that has, well, been inseparable from my relationship to religious doctrine is understanding the ways in which it has been abused. The knowledge itself has been abused, and that in some sense it seems that can't be separated from the nature of the knowledge itself, that there's something inherently dangerous about knowledge.
Yeah.
Of course, it's in all the myths.
Yeah. Yeah, even in, I mean, that's what also the story of Adam and Eve is about in great deal. There really is this notion in in the church fathers, in St. Ephrem the Syrian or St. Irenaeus, like really early church fathers, this idea that God forbade the tree of knowledge from Adam and Eve. And if Adam and Eve had obeyed his commandment, then God would have given them the fruit of the tree. And so it was this idea that you need to approach knowledge in humility. And if you do that, then knowledge actually opens up the way to the tree of life. But if you take it in pride and you take it in self-sufficiency, then actually knowledge will actually stop, will be like a barrier to the higher mysteries. And so I think that for sure, that is really the vision of knowledge. And so Christ, in a way, that's also what happens in the story of Christ. Christ actually eats the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and he does it in accepting to die, right? So he takes on the consequence of the tree. He takes it with humility, because God said, if you eat of that tree, you will die. And said, Christ basically says, okay, I'll die. And so in dying, then he has access to the highest mystery. And that's why when Christ dies, the veil of the temple is ripped apart. It's a way also to show that Christ in that moment, you know, reaches all the way to the tree of life and to Hades at the same time. So he stretches out through the entire hierarchy in one moment of humbly eating the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, basically.
So that's, you're taking the human perspective of Christ there.
What do you mean? Well, in the sense that that's what he manifested. I mean, of course, in the divine sense, he was that all along.
Yeah.
Kind of had to play it through, like kind of had to play it out, because he was taking human nature with him. Like he was basically taking human nature into those places. And so that's in that sense, you're right. It's from the human perspective, he basically brought human nature into the Holy of Holies and into Hades, and then brought them all, you know, brought everything out.
So yeah, the complete human experience there, the complete spectrum. And then, I mean, the reason I threw that question out there was because while you were talking, it was occurring to me that, and this is something I've looked at in the past a little bit, partly inspired by Steiner, who I know, you know, has some dodgy stuff, but he had some interesting things to say about Christ as well. And that from the divine perspective, that God incarnating as Christ was a way for God to experience death, i.e. to experience the full human experience. And then you framed it in terms of God incarnating and then eating the forbidden fruit that he had cast out his own creations for eating. So it's almost as though God was I don't want to say atoning, because I might start getting Gnostic there, but like God, what God had ordained and decreed and manifested, God then had to undergo also.
Well, it's almost like, in a way, it's you have to see it kind of as, let's say, humanity eating the tree of the fruit, eating the fruit of the tree in pride, and then falling, and so then moving out into the world, and you see it all the way to the flood. So that movement towards the flood is a movement towards Hades, right? It's the entire, it's a little microcosm. You know, you see it, Adam and Eve falling, and then you get these technologies and civilizations that set themselves up, and it gets more and more violent and more technical, until you reach the edge of the world, and then there's a flood. So it's like, then the idea is that Christ kind of goes, he follows that trip down, but then he comes back. And so in coming back, he has to bring everything back and go beyond the tree of good and evil. And so he has to eat the fruit, but coming back in towards the tree of life. Like I said, the image presented in the Church Fathers is that Adam and Eve were placed in the garden in a middle zone, let's say. And they could go up towards God, and the idea really is that the destiny, or like what God created man so that man would become God, so that was the point of creating man, was that he could join himself with his creation. That was from the beginning, that's what he wanted. And then in that sense also rejoin all of creation into God. So it's like, it's almost really like this kind of creating the world, but then joining myself to the world through my union with man. That's what Adam was created to do, that, but he didn't. He failed because he took the fruit out of pride. And so Christ basically accomplishes what Adam was supposed to accomplish and brings everything back up. And then the idea of God becoming man is also creation entering into God. So it's not just God entering into creation, but it's the other way is true as well. It's also creation going up into God. And St. Paul talks about it explicitly. He talks about Christ gathering all things into God. And so that's what the incarnation is.
Like you said before, I mean, early on, that we're really talking about something that's impossible.
Well, yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, that's why it's described as a scandal, as a folly, as all, you know, St. Paul talks about it as this madness, right? There's something that's mad about all of that. It's mad about this impossible possibility. I mean, even if you see the words, we say Christ had two natures. Like, what exactly, like, let's even think about what that means. How can something have two natures? That doesn't.
Yeah, without being a hybrid.
Right, completely, yeah, so it's this language of aporia that is used to describe something which is both impossible, but at the same time, if you see it properly, you understand that it's the source of all possibility,
Yeah, well, it's like, it's impossible for the infinite to express in something that's finite, on the one hand, but looks at from another point of view, it's impossible for the infinite not to express.
Exactly. That is exactly the right way to see it. If you read the Dionysian the text corpus, there you go. If you read the corpus of Dionysius the Areopagite, that's exactly what he says. It's like God is completely removed from all creation. There is no trace of God in creation. It's impossible. God is absolutely transcendent, absolutely beyond all name, beyond all concept, beyond all of things. But at the same time, all of creation can only manifest God, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like this, it's really pulling the extreme to both extremes to show what the infinite talks about, because that's the whole problem. You know, you can't have the infinite as something standing above creation. You need there to be a way for it to at the same time be completely removed from everything particular, but also containing all that is particular and kind of encompassing all that is particular, right? So that's the problem of the infinite. So that's a way to what you said, I think is right on in terms of seeing how the Christian vision of it is.
So then, like, in terms of how to live this awareness, it seems as though the apparent impossibility of it, which coexists with the inevitability of it, what it's pointing towards is a necessary letting go of our concepts about reality. And I would say specifically, like, this whole methodology we have, I guess you could say it's kind of a scientific method, but I'm not sure if it's limited to that. But this whole idea that knowledge is something that we can accumulate, and then we can build knowledge, and we can build a knowledge base, and then we can apply it, and somehow it's the Tower of Babel, that somehow we'll eventually get to the truth through knowledge. It seems as though the crux and the real meaning and the real fruit, the fruit of life even, of this recognition that it's the infinite is impossible to relate to, but impossible not to relate to, is seeing the futility of knowledge.
Well, I don't think that knowledge is futile. I think that we need to. I mean, the Christian way to live it is clear. It's Christ says it all the time, and it's love. That's what love is. Love is this notion of two things being completely joined, but at the same time being completely separate, right? Because love, if I love you, I don't want to fuse you into myself. Like, I don't want you to vanish as a person. I want you to stay completely you, completely separate from me, but then I want there to be a unity between us, right? And so that's why also the Trinity is represented the way it is. And in terms of love, is this notion of absolute unity and absolute multiplicity, completely, you know, both completely together and completely separate in love, right? So the Father is not the Son is not the Spirit is not the Father, but they are all absolutely one without division in the divine essence, right? So it's once again, it's an impossibility. But if you see it in terms of what we talked about before, in terms of infinity, you can understand how, in a way, the Trinity is possibly one of the, I mean, I think it's the highest vision of the infinite that that's ever been formulated, right? Because first of all, and how love actually is the key to to infinity is that's the Christian way. And so love is the Christian solution to how to live our relationship to the infinite. So love of God, but also love of others. And then that love of others, all of us loving each other and loving God, is what does that, exactly that. It brings us together, then it brings us all into God, but we don't disappear. Like, we don't fall like a drop in the ocean of Brahma, where we just vanish into Brahma, right? We actually, multiplicity continues to have value, even though we totally understand that we're completely separate, but we're also completely united. There's no other way to say it besides that.
Well, that I was gonna go to that earlier when you were talking about Christ and how he had all these countless aspects that seemed to contradict each other but didn't. That to me spoke to that Christ is humanity, and that humanity is Christ, and therefore Christ has to represent all the different aspects of humanity, as in all the different apparent individuals. Although, right, again, there's this contradiction, because if humanity is one soul and that soul is Christ, I don't want to get too carried away here, but
Christ, I mean, Christ uses that image. He says, what you do to the littlest of these, you do to me. Like, he also puts himself into every individual. Like, he says, I am there in all, even up to the margin, like, right, even up to the littlest one.
And the most condemned and the reviled. Yeah. So it seems as though that, again, back to this ratio, that in order to approach the infinite, we need a mediator, which is Christ, and that somehow Christ, he represents or embodies the possibility of the finite meeting the infinite without being annihilated by it. Yeah. And that the ratio between you or I as an individual and God is the collective humanity, which would seem infinite to you or I in our egos, but it's still finite. It's so vast.
It could be represented as not necessarily as the quantity, but as nature, like our human nature itself, and as we are extension, as we are hypostases, like as we are individual manifestations of human nature, as we participate in human nature, and that human nature has been transformed by Christ, and has been kind of, Christ has become the atom of human nature, right? The source of human nature. That's how kind of everything kind of comes together. Anyways, yeah, this may be a little technical thing, but it's a way to see how we are connected.
Yeah, and so that's the Christ principle of love, as you say, but it's love, it's an active love, which has to be powerful enough to overcome, could even say Darwinian programming, which is survival of the fittest, fight or flight. You know, with a Christ principle being turning the other cheek and resisting not evil and love thy neighbor as thyself, that goes against our deepest programming as just biological entities. We're talking about, you know, how do we embrace our higher nature as part of a collective humanity through love? That the question there is also, how do we overcome this reactive, defensive part of us, which is absolutely terrified by our fellow men and in competition with him? Like, have you read Girard and Mimetic?
A little bit. I know his ideas. I've read it a little bit, but I know his ideas for sure. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, this is quite a good segue into zombies. Because I know that we share that interest, and I think we've covered the light side quite
well.
I feel like we've kind of represented it quite well, and we seem to be on the same page. And that there is a dark side, of course, by definition. And it was occurring to me, I was listening to you talking about zombies, that, I mean, there's all kinds of different ways to look at zombies. They're very rich in symbolism. But one of the things I presume you've talked about is that they represent the inversion of the Christian resurrection.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, and they also represent, like, part of Girard's model, is that the Christ's function was to expose the scapegoat mechanism by showing that the innocent is victim. That the victim is innocent, and that in order to not continue sacrificing innocent victims, in order to stay bonded as a community, in order not to need scapegoats, we have to imitate Christ and actually not compete, not aspire to, not imitate each other, just all imitate Christ, this higher ideal, and that this is the solution towards mimetic rivalry, which leads to mimetic violence. And we're in a time now with democracy, to put it, you know, oversimplified, but, you know, the democratization of the world, that essentially the principles that Girard talks about with mimetic rival, which is essentially that because we're imitative creatures, we desire what we see others have, but also even what they desire. And because we imitate, you know, each other's desires, so then we end up competing for the same thing, and so then we end up rivals, and then violence erupts in the community. That's essentially it, the model, and hence then we need a scapegoat, because then you talk about this higher ideal, the pole that people can focus towards and be unified. Well, the scapegoat is the dark side of that.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a way for the community to be unified. So that's an issue in small communities, never mind large ones. Now we have a global community in McLuhan's Global Village, where everybody can imitate everybody else. Everybody, and even values becoming normalized or unified.
Mm.
Like the value set is more or less becoming universal.
Yeah.
So we're all sort of being conditioned to aspire towards the same things, and therefore to see each other all as rivals.
Yeah.
So the potential for mimetic violence is enormous now. It's like, really, we're in this powder keg that seems like it could just go off at any point.
Yeah.
I agree.
Especially in Europe, and now I guess in the United States as well, for sure. It's not, you can feel the tension. You can feel it just kind of getting higher and higher. I think that the tension we're feeling now has to do with the unresolved World War II. Like, we never resolved what happened in World War II. We just stepped right over it. And if you don't resolve something, it comes back. So we're just going to see it happen again. I think I don't see any other way, sadly, but hopefully not. But it seems like we're replaying the same game again. People have not learned, so it's sad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a specific example, sort of the micro and the macro with World War II, it's a subject that is so divisive now. Like, it's very difficult to talk about what happened in World War II. Like, you can't question the narrative.
No.
Without being demonized right away. And so, of course, that's an indication that, as you said, something's unresolved, but also that there's a mechanism in place to prevent a resolution.
Yeah.
So it's a psychological one, certainly, but probably a social one too. And so that's a really good sort of clear-cut example of something that seems to be pervasive now, which is that the things we most need to talk about are the most difficult to talk about because they're the most polarizing.
Yeah. And I always think that in a way that a pole, like you talked about the pole and the tree. Yeah. You always have to understand the tree with its branches, right? just the pole is dangerous to a certain extent. You need people turning around it. You need the branches. And a hierarchy, a normal hierarchy, should be able to prevent, to a certain extent, let's say total scapegoating. In what sense? In the sense that everything, the hierarchy, in a way, it will separate you from the center, let's say, but it also show the manner in which you have access to it. So it's always this play. One of the problems we're seeing in terms of what's happening now, let's say that the conflict that's happening now, is that we don't want there to be a margin. We want to say everything is inside, like everything participates, right? Everything participates. We want to pull everything in. We want there to be nothing that is undefined. We want there to be no buffer of chaos on the edge. So everything that is undefined, we're trying to define it. We're saying this also, this has a name, this has a name, this has a name. That obviously that explodes into, I mean, the LGBTQ, PA, blah, 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 right? Because there are exceptions are indefinite. There's an indefinite amount of exceptions. But as we do that, we're trying to fit everything in. Things are fragmenting. There's no way to avoid it. And the reaction is going to be the same. And it's sad to see it playing itself out again. You know, I keep telling people, we are exactly in Weimar Germany right now. Exactly the situation that was there in Weimar Germany in the 1920s. We are standing in the same spot, except 10 times more. Mm. It's 10 times more. And so the reaction to that at some point, I'm so afraid of how strong it's going to be and how devastating it's going to be. But it's like people are just blind to understanding that you need to leave some things to kind of exist in an undefined state. Like, it's just, that's just fine. You don't need all your personal idiosyncrasies to be on Instagram. That is not necessary. There's no more room for the private idiosyncrasies that we have. And we all have them. We all have secret desires. We all have secret weirdness about us, secret idiosyncrasies. And those should not be put out in the public spheres like it is now. That can't sustain itself. It's going to collapse, and then there's going to be serious scapegoating, and it's going to be frightening. It's going to be, anyways, I don't want to be a prophet. I hope I'm not, but it just seems like that's what's happening.
Yeah, and to use a obvious example of the transgender thing, which I've written about at length, and it occurred to me at a certain point, also gating my own reactions, that this relates obviously not just to transgender, but generally sort of the raising up of the victim, which has interesting correlations with Christianity, of course, because Christ, the victim, was raised up as this high pinnacle. And now everybody wants to kind of be on that same level. And you say everybody wants to be their own sovereign, you know, sacred identity as a victim. So that's actually a side point, but I think there is an interesting area to look at there.
But it's also important to see what Christ said when he was on the cross.
Yeah.
He said, right. God forgive them, for they know not what they do. He didn't say, you know, burn all those people that made me a victim. He never said that, you know. That's really important to understand. There's a difference between social justice approach and the approach of the martyr. The martyr does not condemn his accusers. It's a very strange thing, but that's really the narrative. That's the story of Christ.
Yeah, and also, as I touched on before, that it was Christ's nature was simply to do what he did and accept that if these were the consequences, these were the consequences, as opposed to seeking out victim status and using it as a means for social empowerment. That's obviously an inversion of it. I didn't mean to make a correlation there, but just in terms of a cycle, a counterfeit. It's like a counterfeit. Yeah. People see something and they aspire to it, but they don't want to do the inner process, so then they create, you know, a surrogate.
Like you said, it is a kind of parody. I mean, it is a kind of, what's happening now, there's some Christian strains in it. Like there are some aspects that obviously do come, like the idea of the victim obviously does come from Christianity. Like it is definitely something that comes out of Christianity. And so now the way it's being played out is very fascinating. It creates an upside down world, which is very strange.
Yeah. And as I was about, it was going to say that it occurred to me at a certain point that all of the people who are pushing for transgender, not just rights, but, you know, special privileges and really a kind of deification of the anomaly, let's say the victim / anomaly, that they could almost have been working to foment prejudice and hatred against transgender. And that's certainly an effect. It's inevitable. It's absolutely inevitable. If you give people special privileges in such a way that a vast number of people are losing their freedom, then they're going to resent these anomalies that previously they didn't even have strong opinions about.
And I know that's really this, and it's the same situation with multiculturalism. It's a sad thing to watch, and every time I see, you know, every time I see, let's say, in the news, especially when it's in the news, you know, you wish it wasn't so public, especially when you see in the news about you know, a certain minority group who demands that their particular little tradition be respected as an accommodation, right, in the law, you think, it's like, oh, it's like, I understand, I respect your tradition, and I'm sure it's beautiful and that it's powerful, but I know how the game is played, and I know that there's a group of people who, like you said, who never resented you before, and now all of a sudden you're polarizing things, and you're creating a group that's going to resent you, and if that group becomes too big, then it's not going to look good, you know. That's why I get the feeling like we're not headed in a very positive direction, let's say. And like I said, it doesn't mean that, in a way, it's like let's say in Quebec, we had the story of a Sikh boy who wanted to bring his knife to school, right? And so asking for an accommodation to have his ritual knife to school. Right. So you think, you know, I think the Sikhs have a beautiful tradition. They have the you know, I think that the Sikhs, their texts are beautiful. Their psalms are they could almost have been in the Bible. How beautiful they are. And I have a lot of admiration for their story. But still, I also understand that you have to be careful, because when you are an exception, you have to be careful the manner in which you attract attention to yourself, because that not all that attention is going to be good. Like you may create a group of people that will, like you said, that will resent you even though they never resented you before.
Yeah, who actually just looking for a target for all of their unexpressed rage and hostility, and then you're volunteering for it. And I mean, even before that, like everybody wants to be special is the thing. Like we all have that innate in us, whether it's through trauma, I would say probably more likely we've all had difficult childhoods where we were ignored by our parents and we've been imprinted with a need for validation. That sounds, speaking personally, but I do think it's pretty universal. And so we all have this innate kind of sort of quietly desperate need to be validated as special. This is a good example of mimesis, actually, of social contagion. If we're seeing more and more cases of people who have felt victimized or felt marginalized, it's not victimized, but now they're almost becoming synonymous. They felt marginalized, underappreciated, and they're seeing, oh, look, that person feels like I did because of a totally different reason, but now they're getting special consideration. Mm-hmm. They're being raised up. Then people will imitate that, and they'll come up with more and more ways to stand out and get special treatment. And we all know, you know, if you've just been to school or just grown up with siblings, you know that if somebody else is getting special treatment, that triggers your own feeling of insecurity. Okay. And then you want to compete with that. And even if it means, you know, demonizing the other, but certainly you're going to resent them.
I understand this at such a personal level, because I'm from Quebec, right? And I'm French Canadian, and my first language is French. And you know, the French Canadian, the French Canadians colonized Canada, but then the British recolonized the French Canadians. And right. So the French Canadians were basically colonized by the British. And there was a lot of injustice and a lot of things they did. You know, they tried to basically assimilate the French Canadians by force. And there was a lot of stuff, you know, nasty stuff happening. And the British had all the property and had all the power and all the money. Okay. Now the French Canadians got power, you know, political power. And now, you know, out of their frustration of what happened to them before, they required from the federal government special privileges. And now Quebec has these kind of special privileges, you know, compared to other Canadians. And, you know, you go to Alberta or you go to British Columbia and you go to other places in Canada. And of course, they totally resent, you know, the French Canadians. And on the one hand, I understand the fact that the French Canadians came up with these demands, you know, to right some wrongs that were done in the past, but it's a dangerous game to play, because then you end up being, then you will end up being a scapegoat. If things start to go a bit off and things start to be a bit unstable, then where are all the eyes going to turn? They're going to turn to us and they're going to say, no more of you, like, get out, you know, like, we've had enough of you. And so I've seen it in my own, like, in my own people, that process and how dangerous I think it can be.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm somebody who has always striven to stand out, and I would say that's been compulsive and neurotic for sure. And now I'm living in a small town and run a thrift store, and so half the town knows me now because, you know,
right, they buy
used clothing from me. But I'm also this writer and podcaster and all the rest of it. And for quite a long time, I've only been doing it for a couple of years, but I kept the two lives completely separate. I wouldn't let any of my local Facebook friends really know about what I was doing on the internet.
Right.
But with books coming out, I've done a local reading, and I'm doing this local newsletter. So I'm writing stuff for the local community. So those two lives are now intersecting.
Oh, wow.
And I'm discovering that, and Jordan Peterson's talked about this, that there's something innate in us, and I've been aware of it myself. It's sort of this paradox at my core that wants to blend in, that wants to be invisible.
Yeah.
Because that's safe.
Yeah.
It's a deep programming that, you know, we don't want to be scapegoated, we don't want to be picked off by predators, we just want to blend in.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm experiencing this quite viscerally in the community. Like the more attention I manage to get and the more appreciation I get for my work, the less comfortable I am actually in my community. Because now, you know, I can't just blend in. And it's not just people recognize me from the thrift store. Now they recognize me as this deep thinker and writer, not that they necessarily care, but still the fact that I'm actually being seen more nakedly as who I am.
Yeah.
That actually is an inherently destabilizing, it's a bit like that threshold between order and chaos, really. Like the more you let yourself be seen and known by your community, the more attention you get, the harder it is to predict.
You can flip either way. It could go, that's why, you know, yeah, the people who are the highest, if they step off, then they are the ones who get pummeled. You know, you don't pummel the local butcher if he cheats on his wife, but the politician who's in the public eye and who's grandstanding, if that person, you know, cheats on his wife, then all of a sudden it's like, you know, here comes the flaming arrows. So for sure, it's a dangerous place to stand. I've had the same situation as you, where, you know, I'm an icon carver. And so, you know, and I write on symbolism. I mean, like, who cares about that? No one cares about that. And so the people who would flock to whatever I'm doing, I mean, I knew how pointed and how isolated that was. And so now for the weird, just the fact that I was friends with Jordan Peterson, and that in that I've appeared on some of his videos, all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait a minute. And so now, you know, I go places and then people sometimes, not often, but it's happened, you know, where people recognize me. And then now here in Quebec, people are asking me to do some some talks and to now have a more public position. And I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute. You know, I have friends, let's say good friends, who I never talk about politics with, and who all of a sudden will see me in a different light because I'm associated with Jordan Peterson, because he's been so demonized in the press. And I told my wife, I said, you know, you have to be ready that we might lose friends. Like, we might lose friends pretty soon, because it's a double-edged sword for sure to be somewhat recognizable. I think that I could go on, but I need like at 2:30 I would need to go.
Okay.
So like 15 more minutes.
15 minutes. Okay. Well, I'll because I also want to bring it all together a little bit.
Okay.
And,
all right.
This certainly will open it up. There's no way we'll be able to get through it in 15 minutes, but hopefully it will make the whole thing a little more coherent. In terms of what's going on in the world right now, it seems that we've more or less found ourselves congruent about the deeper spiritual understanding of our potential in Christ. We also seem to be more or less in agreement about what's going on in the world. Now, to me, what's really fruitful is to look at the way that those two things intersect. And even in my own trajectory, I would say that my coming to a more Christian perspective, a more fully embodied experience of the divine, has been through exploring the darkness. And for many years now, I've been researching and writing about something I call organized malevolence. And my viewpoint is actually a very Christian one, which is that there are powers of darkness at work in this world, and that they are observable, but they're very well concealed. And so when we're talking about the situation we're in now, we're all collectively in, and this feeling of that it's leading into some very dark times, I have two things to say about this, and hopefully we'll give you something to respond to. One is that I feel that this has been orchestrated and organized and directed intentionally by human beings, but let's say things that work through human beings. I definitely don't want to come off as paranoid here, but this is based on research, and I just found it to be consistent with Christian doctrine, Satan is prince of this world and so on. those basic tenets of Christianity. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is this, the Christian view, I'll be interested in your take on this, that that there is an end times program, if you will, mm-hmm. and that there is a period in which the archetypal force or figure of Antichrist holds sway over human consciousness. Yeah. So that's actually kind of how I've always understood the times we live in. I no longer know for an end times, because who knows how long this could go on.
Right.
But the overarching point is that A, this is all orchestrated in a way, it's not random, but B, that the grand architect is God, and that there is a divine purpose to mm-hmm. everything that's happening and unfolding now that is leading us into a deeper understanding of our nature through a recognition of the darker aspects of it.
Yeah. Well, okay, so Christ has this, Christ says, you know, I don't know if I'm going to quote this right in English, but he says something to the extent that there must be scandal, right? Scandal is part of the story. There has to be scandal. But woe to those who participate in that scandal. Woe to those who cause the scandal, let's say. And so there is this idea, like you said, definitely I see, to me, I see a repeat in the story of Christianity, a repeat of the story of Christ himself, where there has to be this kind of descent, like you said, into death, you know, and the spirit of Antichrist is part of the Christian story. Kind of manifesting the opposite, or manifesting, you know, and then who knows exactly what that means and how it's going to happen, but that in the end there's going to be a surprise, just like Christ going into Hades, you know, that you think everything is finished. Yeah. And, you know, Tolkien called it the eucatastrophe, right? Everything looks like it's over, like there's nothing, no more possibility. And then suddenly this glorious resurrection, really, is the only way to put it. And so I totally agree with you. I think that we have to be careful how we phrase it, because we have to be careful not to phrase it in a sense that would give value to the darker aspects, let's say, that would say, you know, kind of in a, like, let's say, how could I express this? Almost like a Luciferian way, where you would positively want to explore, you know, sinful acts in order, because you think that it's going to transform you somehow, you know, something like that. I think that's definitely not the Christian way, but there is definitely the notion that it has to happen. Like, there has to be this descent of history into death, into chaos. And it's not just in Christianity. I mean, this idea of this kind of fall into the end times, you could say, is there in so many religions. It's not just Christian. Muslims also believe in Antichrist, and that Christ will come and at the end. And you know, the Hindus have the idea of the Kali Yuga, and you have, it's there in so many traditions. So I think that definitely, and I would agree, I definitely think that we are kind of in the upside down right now, and you know, that the spirit of Antichrist is definitely ruling at this moment. As for the kind of idea of the program, or let's say the directed aspect of it, you know, I tend to not touch that too much, in the sense that I don't think it makes a difference. Not that I don't believe it's possible. I do believe it's possible that, like, you know, that there are conspiracies, or that there are even dark organizations that are, you know, pushing things in a direction or another. I'm sure there are, but I've noticed that people who focus on that too much, usually they're not focused on the right thing, in the sense that we need to, you know, you need to be focused on being a saint. Like, you need to be focused on how you can be a light in the world, like how you can be that light that Christ talked about, the salt of the earth, the light in the world, because there's nothing we can do about those dark agents if they're there. Like, if there are, you know, secret organizations leading us into chaos, it's quite possible, but there's nothing we can really do about it except love your neighbor. You know, that's kind of how my approach to that question, let's say.
Yeah, I think I agree, except that And this brings to an interesting point that there's something in our Western mindset which says that if you're going to see something, you need to do something about it. Like the only reason to see something or look at something is in order to do something about it. And of course, that's very runs counter to the psychoanalytical process of the Jungian, the notion. I'm not really a Jungian myself, but I do think there's value in that. That there's an inherent value simply in seeing reality in all its aspects, and that of course there's going to be a natural tendency in us not to want to see the worst aspects, and therefore there's something liberating in actually voluntarily go like Christ in Hades again, voluntarily entering into the darkest aspects of experience and being willing to see them. And I think actually sort of paradoxically the real value in that is being able to see them and not do anything about them. And that's been my process. Like it's really been a struggle, and it's been I've been compelled because of my own family history and my own childhood that it turns out that there has been I've been impacted by those things in some way that I'm not fully conscious of. So something in me has driven me to go into that. And I would agree, it's a pretty unhealthy sort of field, because most people who go into that are obsessive, and they do approach it in this proactive way, which is very counterproductive. Like if you're talking about something that's a deep level, even spiritual principles of darkness, you don't want to be approaching them in a combative mode. This is like, the worst possible approach. And they're not generally, it's more they're seeing it at a sociological level, whereas I've always seen it at a spiritual level. It's just that I'm interested in the ways it can actually be mapped all the way into right. our daily lives. And I think there is something inherently freeing in that. But at bottom, it just comes down to wanting to see the nature of the world, like what is the nature of the world? And what do we value? As in, do we value the world? Or do we value that which is eternal and which cannot be represented by the world?
Yeah.
And is there a conflict between those two things? Because I believe there is. I think worldly values aren't really compatible with Christian values.
I think that's definitely not. That's not. There's nothing strange. Nothing controversial about it at all. Christ talks about this world, in rather negative terms. That in a way that you could see that there is a difference between the world in the sense of the world that God created that is good, that can be full of divine light, that can be full of God's presence. And then there's also the notion of this world in the sense of this world as being ruled over by, like you said, by dark desires, dark passions, dark forces. And so, I mean, our world is definitely, our world is definitely not under, well, it's weird. I've had this discussion with somebody, because I tend to see things very negatively. I tend to see things in terms of a descent, and I see the spirit of Mammon as being, ruling over pretty much everything right now, and that we're ruled by our desires for objects, for riches, for sex, we're basically ruled by these dark forces, right? But at the same time, someone really pointed out to me, and he said, has there ever been a society in the world where we took as much care of the poor, let's say in a Western society, in the history of the world? Has there ever been a society where as a society, we take care of the poor more? And my answer is no, you're right. There has never been a society where we care for the poor like we do in our society. And so it's a weird mix. It's as if the only way I can make sense of it is this notion that Christ talks about the wheat and the chaff growing together, and that the wheat and the chaff grow together. And at the end, the scythe will come and will separate the wheat from the chaff. And that to me, that's the only way to make sense of it, because like you said, I do see that we are ruled by very dark, dark things, but I can't deny the fact that my neighborhood is safer than probably any neighborhood in pretty much the entire history of the world until very recently. where I don't, you know, there is no, I have no fear of bandits coming to my house. I have no fear of being attacked in the, on the road. I have no, none of those fears exist in my world, right? Those are normal fears in any world before our times. And so it's like there's those two things at the same time. I don't know if you've thought about that.
That's recent for me to
notice that.
I absolutely have. I wrestle with it every day because I have a very strong conviction that things are worse and worse. I argue with my wife about it. And yet, in my life and in my this town I live, everything seems, there's damaged, broken people everywhere, and I deal with them every day, and I see the human suffering. I'm not denying that aspect. I can see the darker aspects. But basically, yes, I live a very comfortable life. And so the way I reconcile that myself, and hopefully it's not just a rationalization, I think it is based on things I've investigated, is that the jeopardy we're in is becoming more and more of a soul level jeopardy. Yeah. Like our physical comfort, yes, is taken care of by those same forces that really don't have our interests, best interests at heart. That's my sense. And so
there's something really true about what you're saying, definitely. That it's a with that we have us, our spiritual disease, let's say, is growing faster and faster. I mean, I don't know, it's like half of people are on antidepressants. It's absolutely insane. It's like 70% of kids are on these attention drugs, you know. And so it's obviously our spiritual disease is growing, and so we're kind of keeping it in check with all these drugs, but at some point the zombies are gonna break out. Can you imagine? Like I always kind of joke and tell people, like, what would really destroy our society is if the pharmaceutical line was cut for like 2 months and no one could get their pharmaceuticals, then then people would be eating each other in the streets.
And the internet went down.
Yeah, exactly. It would be the apocalypse immediately.
Yeah. Instant apocalypse. Just add water and mix.
Yeah.
Good talking to you anyway. I'm glad we got to hook up.
Yeah, it was good to meet you. Tell me when the podcast is up, and I'll definitely share it on social media.
Yes, I will do that. As a just a professional question, do you know who Saint Cyrus is, or Cyrus or Cyprus? It's a saint that Charles Upton recommended I get an icon of, because he's the saint of, he's a reformed sorcerer. He was a sorcerer and then he became a saint. And not that I'm aspiring to sainthood, but I definitely am a reformed sorcerer. So,
yeah, that's definitely interesting. I'd never heard of a saint of reformed sorcerers.
Yeah, me neither.
That might be useful at some point.
Chip on my shoulder, a sad lunk. Sergeant said, have your way. She says she's here for holiday. Well, show her your carnival. Let some steam off, boy, from that samovar. I could see the bruises on her shoulders. She shrugged as she heard the door shut.
That's the end of my conversation with Jonathan Pageau. Thanks to Jonathan for agreeing to do that. You can find out more about Jonathan on his website, which is linked in the show notes. Some of my listeners might be wondering why I didn't ask Jonathan about Jordan Peterson, considering how much of my attention is on the Jordan Peterson phenomenon. Well, the reasons are various. For one thing, I don't really feel that Jordan Peterson is the right context for Jonathan Pageau. I mean, I know that's how he's become much more well known, but I think that he's
much more interesting in his own right than in the context of the Jordan Peterson phenomenon, so I didn't want to squish him into that box. It was also a question of diplomacy, because Jonathan's obviously friends with Jordan, and it didn't seem that it would be appropriate or strategically effective, let's say, to ask Jonathan to discuss Jordan through a critical lens. Maybe someday, if Jonathan and I talk again, things change in the general landscape around Jordan Peterson, that might be possible. My series Answer to Jordan, 13 Reasons to Watch Jordan Peterson Closely, is underway now, up to part 2. I hope it will continue all the way to all 13 points, which I have listed, but I don't have the essays actually written as yet. Next week, the podcast is with Jameson Webster, and we do talk around the Jordan Peterson phenomenon. After that, it's with Nicholas Hausdorff, which is mostly entirely about Jordan Peterson. So apparently this is continuing to be a sort of catalyst for explorations, although I don't feel it's really limited to the Jordan Peterson phenomenon per se, any more than Prisoner Infinity is limited to Whitley Strieber as a phenomenon. It's just a launching pad for excursions into new realms of perception, let's say, analysis, cultural analysis. Right, well, this is Jason Horsley once again for The Liminalist, the podcast between. If you'd like to support this enterprise, you can donate in the margin at the website, horticulture.com/liminalist, or you can support me in other non-financial ways by commenting, or sharing, or telling your friends about this, spreading the word, helping out in that way.
In the corners of my eyes, and let her run out. Arrange for a safe passage and a carriage. No. Oh, oh, Holly. Oh, Holly, say, I wipe her Holly spit from my brow. If you held in your palms a beautiful song, is it wrong to want the weak when you're strong? Would you let her run out, no turning back? Or would you crush her legs with the squeeze of your hand?